research and how research develops and how I developed research. And interesting question. And I think it all starts in never growing up, in a way. The child's curiosity in some people seems to stop, and some people it actually stays, and some people actually learn to focus on it. I think that scientific research is a continuation of this question of how, what, where, when, why. As a child goes in this realm of wonder, of discovering this world around and discovering that things seem to hang together somehow, but it's not always evident. And evidently there have been people who then answer because, or because I said so, and religions do nothing different when they say because God said so. Those are the kind of cop-out questions where you don't get an answer, and a lot of people are in a way shut up by that. They stop thinking, or they stop questioning, and they stop doing research. And of course in the history of the Western world, had the stopping of questioning what was actually going on came from the Catholic Church in a specific way, or let's call the Roman Church, the Church of the Romans. That was not such a good thing, because in Rome people lived to become 90 years old, and after the Catholic Church took over, people lived to become around 35 years old. So there was more going on in not knowing, maybe also a bit of not caring. And science and research turns that around. It has a form of caring which comes out of knowing and wanting to know. Of course, there are different forms of research. The people who only look at the superficial, let's call them the classical scientists who study matter. They want to see how things tick and why things fall, and in doing so they break things rather than make things. And then there's the relativistic scientists who realize that things are always context dependent. They're more chemical than physical. It's always an interaction relationship. It's always changing. And then, of course, there are people who grow up to a kind of scientific puberty, who go into the probabilistic science, that there is a limit to what we know, but we can transcend those limits. We can come to new understanding by changing our perspective, by changing our involvement. We have to be very careful in doing so, because things can blow up catastrophically. Atomic nuclear physics is an example of that. But there is also that form of science, the unified field science, the integrated science, let's call the mystical science, or the consciousness science, science of consciousness, that is the group of people who realize that by our thinking, we actually create new conditions for perceiving and new possibilities to learn about what goes on around us. By essentially seeing beyond what we see. That essentially is the old tradition of occultism, that you're able to look beyond what you see and to understand what is hidden by what you see, and you need to look into that. It needs an art of abstraction. So science is not just looking at things with an interest, but also having an interest about why did you not see that before? And why did you think about it in that way, while evidently you could have thought about it in a different way as well? So maybe with that as a kind of starting point for what I now see is a sense of science, let me answer your implied question of how that worked for me. Yes, as a child, like every child, I asked the questions. Like a child, like most children, I got some answers. And also in school, I discovered that school had a lot of answers, even to questions which I hadn't asked yet. But also, I discovered that some of those answers were useless. or actually later in the gymnasium, I discovered that the answers which had been given at one time were no longer suitable, useful, effective as another time. So that what we know has changed, what we understand has changed, but somehow people never describe that as we learn to think differently. It was always formulated as somebody discovered something new and then things changed. Somebody was able to discover that bronze was easier to form than a flint rock and could be given many different shapes, also hollow shapes, which a flint rock doesn't do that easily. So the Bronze Age was different than the Stone Age. And it is not always presented as there was this discovery of the use of fire in combination with specific kinds of rocks as a result of which you could discover metals. And after the Bronze Age, the Iron Age was not much of a change, but it changed from the Iron Age to the Machine Age or the Steam Age was different in the sense that suddenly the fire was not just smelting bronze or iron, but was able to do something else. So there wasn't that much difference in the transition from the Iron Age to the Steam Age. It was simply that fire was understood better. And why did that take so long? But there was a difference in the transition from the Steam Age and machines to the Computer Age. In the Machine Age, there were already understandings of putting parts together and having the work together as a machine. But then a computer is essentially a machine without steam, or rather the understanding that steam is heat, is electron flow, electromagnetic flow. So once you look over the hundreds of years, you can see that the change of thinking is profound, but actually not so fundamental. The transition from cooking pots to melting bronze or steel, bronze, iron, and then steel, is a gradual change of the same principle. The understanding of forming bronze or steel, iron or steel, to form machinery is a different kind of thinking which comes in. And it is those kind of levels of thinking which I can now describe because I experienced them. I, as a child, had the questions in school. I learned some of the answers. I learned some of the very nonsensical answers. In the gymnasium, they had all the myths and sagas of the old cultures, but they never explained that those were their means to cope with the things that they didn't know, in having a kind of recipes to deal with the unknown. The question never came up that questions are actually tools, like forks or knives, to tackle the unknown, to be able to digest, to come to eat and digest the unknown. So even though I had what's called good schooling, I find that that schooling was abominable. It was stupid. It was lacking understanding. Specifically, it was lacking the connections. But at that time, I didn't know that. There was an intuitive kind of dissatisfaction with what I was learning, even though there were many interesting bits about what I was learning. But it's no more than seeing pieces of a puzzle sort of put on a table and somebody say, well, look at what a wonderful little thing this is. How the biology teacher or the physics teacher or the mathematics teacher or the language teacher, and all having their little bit of the puzzle, but not realizing that these are pieces of a puzzle that you can fit together. I had this inherent dissatisfaction with how I was learning, say, rather than what I was learning. And also, I just wasn't aware of it. They weren't aware of it. It took me a very long time before I came to understand that everything is connected, everything is interconnected. And when I look back at the schools where I was and the way I was taught, it is so primitive, it is so backwards, it is so obsolete. Maybe it's not much better than the storytelling in the schools of Plato or Socrates, where even then they'd had more interest in why do you think this? And why do you not think the opposite? The discourses of Plato are always about comparing opposite points of view. And of course, the big learning from looking at opposite points of view is not that you pass or fail the exam and that the teacher is right and the student is wrong, even though when later it turns out that the opposite is the case. But it is about the understanding that when there are two different perspectives and both people hold them to be right, there must be a deeper kind of perspective of insight and learning and seeing which is not being seen. And it's actually only recently that I came to that understanding, that you actually must be able to understand the opposites to realize that both sides are wrong, which of course changes the politics of the whole planet, rather of humanity. But you can only understand it once you start to see that it is never about what you're looking at, what they call objective science, but how you're looking at it, subjective science. The path that I followed was, let's say, traditional. Much of that is conditioning in the way of thinking of people. People are in a way formatted like a hard disk, and then information is written into that disk. And sometimes there are bad sectors where the information doesn't hold, as a result of which the program might have glitches and bugs in it. And the result is that people don't behave as foreseen. But that's all because that whole idea of programming people as if formatting and writing information on a hard disk is wrong. The way we work and the way we think, and that of course is the tool, the foundation of science, lies in our ability to work differently, to think differently. But the whole difference between say an electrical circuit in a household where you can have a short circuit and light bulbs blow up, or computers where the light bulbs don't blow but things cannot change nevertheless, in our body things can blow up and they can repair themselves. And the circuits can rebuild itself, it can become a new circuit. So there's a fundamental difference between the science of dead matter, say of electric circuits or circuit boards in computers, to the science of life and biology, of the science of consciousness, where new information can destabilize or dissolve old information, and where information can be compacted. It's not just that we add information in our understanding, but we also add understanding in our information. It's not just that we add more knowledge, but we are able to digest it and compress it and condense it into something that works in our life, and that turns it into wisdom, knowledge with experience. I wasn't there yet when I started on this curriculum of scientific research. I have to add that I realized that things were different. That's why I stepped into a curriculum of independent science research. So I'm an independent research scientist, because I discovered in research centers, those are academic, which means essentially that they're government, which essentially means that they are think tanks for somebody's interest, are very often applied for a military interest or political interest. That means that scientific research has a hidden, a more or less hidden, or a totally not hidden political agenda. People just don't know about the political agenda because the more the agenda is political, the more the center of research is not public but private. In this sense, it is private either that it is corporate or private that it works for, let's say, the secret services of the different nations and the interest groups behind them. There are many people who study research, who go into that path of becoming researchers, scientists. The researcher is somebody who explores, and the scientist is somebody who thinks he knows or she knows. Both of them feed into each other, a bit of left leg and right leg and walking. Either you do research and you get to know things and then you have new science. So those are the developmental scientists or the exploratory scientists, the scientists who create new information. But you also have a lot of scientists who are only at the level of knowing something. Basically, they're storyteller repeater stations. They learn something in school, then they go to a university or some other place of learning. They learn something there, they write a text about it, and then they talk about what they have written their text about and what they have learned. But those are just stories of others. So the scientists who are storytellers or repeater stations are a different category of thinkers. They have a different mind than the researchers. Let me juxtapose them. The scientists who are storytellers, repeater stations, when they have talks in conferences or other settings, they tell to refer to other researchers or to other research. They have a lot of footnotes, and they try to build up a persuasive argument, a bit like a preacher in a church, of how people can come to think in that manner and why it might be interesting to believe that thing. And Gurdjieff and others have, of course, had the sport that they would have meetings with people and they would develop an argument referring to different kinds of information. And then there would be a break, and then they would use the opposite arguments and come to the opposite conclusion. Protagoras is one of the Greek philosophers who was known for that. So it means that scientists of that kind often refer to the work of others, and in interaction with other scientists, they most often ask, have you read this, have you read that, do you know of the work of this guy, do you know of the work of that guy? Most often they are guys. And in essence, they are saying, have you read what the kind of stuff that I have read? Do I recognize you? Because otherwise I will not recognize you. And that recognizing or not recognizing is the essence of academic status, of stature. There are groups of people who then have this mutual adulation or mutual adjuration or mutual frames of reference. They share the same notes or the same references, and then they agree with each other for the simple reason that they have been eating the same kind of cakes in the library of the books of learning. Those scientists often have difficulty with the researchers, because the researchers do not have a list of 30 or 50 people that sort of wrote the same story. Those are actually vicious stories in the sense that they repeat ideas and then they repeat them as beliefs and they become hypnotic and they in a way become a kind of superstition. And there are lots of these areas in science where people have been repeating information because they have been repeating each other, because they all had to keep their salary in place, and if they disagreed with others, then their colleagues who are still reading those other books didn't want to know of them. So they got fired. And that is an important lesson in science, that the conditioning of science and the conditioning of scientists is a kind of machinery or ritual, protocol, procedure, in which their way of thinking and their topics of thinking are become interconnected. They're supposed to think about that, and they're supposed to think in this way. So that is what in India they would call the pundits, had the people quoting the books, but those are not the people who have written the books. And writing books about books that have already been written, I would consider to be rewriting books rather than writing books. So let me shift from the scientist to the researcher. The scientists who are rewriting stories and the researchers who are writing stories. And the researchers are a totally different kind of mindset of scientists, because they are puzzling about the unknown. They don't know what they're looking at. They don't know what they're seeing. sometimes they miss over looking at something or seeing something for a very long time, and afterwards suddenly wonder, how was it possible that they did not see it? How could it be that they too were hypnotized like those other people doing the self-repeating stories? And if you look at the development of science, there was this period that people looked at matter and how it moved, and why did it take so long before people realized that there was something like molecules? The alchemists already knew that. They didn't have the word for it as yet, but they knew that apart from the solid fixed materials, there were also fluid materials. So next to the earth element, there was the water element. But they couldn't turn their mind around to realize that when they were dealing with matter, they were not dealing with molecules, and that what they called the water element was essentially the fluid element, or the chemical element, or the flowing element, the electron flow element of molecules. And why did it take so much time before people realized that molecules were made of atoms? The Greeks already described atoms. They already understood it, and even though it was had done, the word atomos came from the uncuttable. If you have a piece of cheese, and of course Greek shepherds have a lot of that, then you cut it smaller, 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 and at some point the piece of cheese that you have cut becomes so small that you cannot cut it again. So it becomes uncuttable, or atomos. Later it was realized that perhaps you should not call that atomos uncuttable, but it was realized that that was called molecular, and that if you want to cut it smaller, you need something else than a knife. You need something actually electromagnetic. You need to work with the electromagnetic field directly, and then you see that atoms are electromagnetic charges, plus, minus, zeros, question marks, mingled together in very specific patterns which are not material, they're not physical. They're not molecular, that means that they're not chemical, but they're atomic, which means that they're electromagnetic. But why did it take so long for people to realize that, even though they already knew that Zeus was the god of lightning, which means that electricity was the chief principle of what happens in the domains of God, which we would call the principles of creation? So when you look at the history of science, then Einstein formulated molecules in the motion of molecules, and Planck formulated the movement of atoms, and they lived in the same time period. So that's 1905, 1918, 1915, thereabouts. The formulation of molecules was there, the formulation of atoms was there, but they couldn't connect it. They couldn't put it together. And even though they understood that they were all describing the parts of physics at the electromagnetic level, Einstein was not understood as describing the molecular level of the relative or relativistic dynamic of molecules, and Planck was describing the atomic changes, which basically are the jumps of electrons at the core of it. And even now, a century later, people are aware that there's matter, there's molecules, there's atoms, and they know that there are electromagnetic fields, but somehow they are not able to disconnect the electromagnetic fields from the material models. So they're not able to let go this notion that things would be material, while we now know that it is the electromagnetic field which forms the atoms, which forms the molecules, which forms the matter. So that matter is a consequence of the electromagnetic field. So we must be able to look at the electromagnetic field without matter, without molecules, without atoms. That's what superstring theory tries to do and fails in doing, because the electromagnetic principles are not interconnected with it, the immaterial electromagnetic principles. So the transition from scientists, which were looking at matter and molecules and atoms, to researchers who were looking at electromagnetic forces and thus electrodynamics and atoms, and thus understanding the electric flow and the electrodynamics of molecules, there's as if a gap between them. And that gap has not been bridged yet. Most of the researchers are still using the model of the scientist to do research, instead of the other way around, of doing research so that you can make new models of science. There are very few of those researchers. Isaac Newton, the alchemist, who was also the formulator of the fundamental principle of physics. Faraday and Maxwell, who were putting the foundation to electromagnetism. They started from an end where other people were not looking. And that is the essence of research, that you look the unknown into the face directly, and you basically don't know what you're seeing, but you are aware that you're seeing something which is unseen, in the sense that you haven't seen it before. You can't see it in everything there is, but nevertheless you can see it in everything that is, even though you cannot see it. That is the art of the alchemist, or the art of the occultist, that you are able to look at what you see to see what you didn't see before. And all of the major leaps in science are due to researchers looking for the things that everybody missed out on. Essentially, that's a philosophical activity. Philosophers are the people who are able to point out what everybody already knows, but to show that they didn't know that they knew it, so that they're actually learning from what they know, because they're able to think in a way they didn't do that before. So I can now, in retrospect, describe how different scientists are from researchers. And of course I need to compare that to how different research is from superstitional belief, which is actually formulated often in the story of the conversation with Descartes and the Pope, that Descartes wanted to do research because of Galileo Galilei, Giordano Bruno, and other people, some of which had been burned at the stake for showing that things were not as the way that the Roman priests were telling it. So that the story of belief and faith, and repeating the story, much of what we see in science nowadays too, is not a very complete explanation. And that there were people who were able to see that things are different, and that burning those people doesn't solve the problem, because it doesn't add knowledge. It doesn't help humanities to survive and deal with those own known situations. That burning the researcher doesn't let the new philosophical or scientific problem go away. It just means that you have gotten rid of the people who were actually seeing it and were potentially able to resolve it. It's like you throw away the thermometer to not see the fever, which is not a good practice. So you need to actually understand what is this fever of the unknown that you're facing and how can you deal with that. Religion had a belief system and that didn't work. Science now has come a belief system that doesn't work. Religion needed to have this offspin into empiricism, which we now call research. And research is the foundation of science as we now know it. So science in itself is just a secondary step in that process. So scientists and unscientists are storyteller and people who say, well, if it is not written down, then it cannot be. Researchers are a different ilk of people. They know that whatever we know, there are things that we do not know, and how can we compute that? How can we fit that in? Coming back to my story, I had a lot of interest and a lot of questions. School did not answer those. I had some experiences. I couldn't find the answer to those. Specifically, as I told another time, I was playing in the brooks in Austria where my parents were having their holiday, and I discovered that the water sometimes piled up behind the dam which I had built, and at other times it just flushed away the dam. So I realized that there was something between the non-moving and the moving. Later I would have described it as material and the chemical, or the static and the dynamic, as it's called in physics. And so I decided to go to the Mecca of hydrodynamics, because that is where I hope to understand this principle of flow, which could evidently carve canyons in mountains. So that the flow must be stronger than the structure. In a way, I had, without knowing it, taken the first step of the understanding of alchemy, that the earth element originates from the water element. The ice is a frozen form of water. I still had to come to the understanding that water is just condensed steam or condensed mist, and that I actually needed to understand the steam principle behind it. I didn't understand that as yet, so I decided to study the things that I didn't know, the things that that I found curious, that relationship between standing still and moving. So I went to the Mecca of hydrodynamic research on the planet, which was Delft. And when I came there, I discovered that they no longer merited that name. There were too many scientists and not enough researchers. And basically, their explanations were too limited and too incomplete. I slowly, gradually came to a different understanding, in which I also came to understand that the whole technical high school, now called the technical university, actually was based on one type of differential equations, and that everybody in all of the buildings along that street were learning the same differential equations, and that in that sense the different pieces of the puzzle no longer were interesting. That you had mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, aerodynamic engineering, physical engineering, chemical engineering, mine engineering, and all these different flavors. I happen to be in civil engineering. They had architectural engineering. All of these flavors are all based on these equations, the differential equations, basically the understanding of Leibniz and Newton, that if you want to understand how the whole connects, you need to look at the details of the connection and the change in the connectedness. So everybody was doing the same equations, but there was no understanding that the way the aerospace engineering guys or where I was the hydrodynamic engineering guys, were actually looking at the same equations with simply a different density of the material. So yes, you can use it for air, as the aerodynamics guys do, or you can use it for water, as the civil engineering guys do, but you can also use it for the materials, as the mechanical engineers do, but you can also use it for electromagnetism, as the electro engineers do. So why was there not that understanding that in those equations everything that that university offered was already integrated, that people were not looking at pieces of the puzzle, but that the puzzle was about how the puzzling takes place, how the puzzling can be done? And that's where I, in a way, would say that the notion of research was not being taught, but instead that a kind of belief in science was being taught, that this is the equation, this is how it works in that setting. And then in the hydraulic engineers, they used it with water. In aerospace engineer, they used it with air. In the electrical engineering, they used it with plasma. Mechanical chemical engineers, they used it with physics. But there was not that understanding that engineering thus means the harnessing of the principle which is contained in those differential equations. And it took me a lot of time to work that out, that it is essentially about the electromagnetic principles of how phase space can go into an electromagnetic field, where the electric and the magnetic are in interplay, as you see in the atomic level, that can lead to electric flows in that electromagnetic field, which we call chemistry, which is here at the molecular level, or that it can actually result in a specific kind of crystallization of the electromagnetic field, or specifically the atoms which are plus, minus, and zeros glued together by the minuses called electrons into what we call matter. So that connectedness in thinking wasn't there. And in retrospect, I'm surprised that I wasn't looking for it. Intuitively, I was looking for a connection, because I was picking up books from all kind of different disciplines in science, and I was going to lectures of physics, mathematics, and at other universities as well. And I realized that within me there was something or somebody who could understand topics which I had never heard about. I've stepped into the lecture on cryophysics and plasma physics, and essentially I was the only guy asking questions, pertinent questions, relevant questions, because I saw that there were some principles in play which followed from the examples which were given, but which were not being formulated. And in that sense, that is the path which I then took. That as an engineer, I knew what I knew, but I also realized that I had no real foundation for what I knew. And so first I spent some time in the British Library to see how other cultures had connected the pieces of the puzzle together. And I realized that what we called science, they would call healing or mythology or magic. But they were all addressing these four principles of alchemy, of how does something solid can be liquid, how can that be a gas, how can that be totally immaterial, plasma, and how is it possible that these things interact between them. It is from there that I realized that matter is molecules glued together by electrons. It's not chemical, it's electromagnetic, but it is highly computed, it is very precise. Likewise, molecules are atoms which are strung together by their electromagnetic fields, which is something which is not tangible, yet dominant in the way the atoms can string up and form patterns, which can then be stuck together by the electrons. But that underlying, we still need to explain, why is it that pluses and minuses and zeros can hang together as atoms, actually that doesn't, It's impossible because a plus and a minus and a zero would that a plus and a minus would cancel out and become another zero, so to say, and the zeros would probably cancel out or do something. But the model doesn't account for that. It just doesn't go to that deeper level of understanding. And in finding what the different cultures had found, I realized that I still didn't understand the foundation of what we know, what we see. That the material that we see is basically just a frozen form of a process that I did learn in engineering school and system theory. That the structure is the form of the process. The process is an aspect of a transformation. And the transformation is actually always information in formation. I was able to formulate that only later. But I was able to formulate that because I didn't become an engineer and go to a place to work and get some money and get buy a grave and be buried. I pursued this notion of what I did not know. What I did know was interesting, but it didn't explain it. It didn't explain it for me, so it didn't explain it for anybody. So I pursued that, and from engineering school, went to the British Library, found that what I had discovered was much more encompassing than I had realized, that it was worldwide, that everybody around the world had understood that alchemical link of the physical is actually a chemical, which is actually electromagnetic, which is actually phase space. And okay, they called it earth, water, air, and fire. But once you understand that, of course, you need to find words for the things you don't understand, and the words can never represent that what you are trying to describe. Then the mind can work with that information in a better way. In a more encompassing way, because you know that you don't know, and you know that if you describe it, you still cannot deal with it properly. But at any level, in any case, you're already steps ahead of where you were when you couldn't describe anything at all. It's like first you have the unknown, and then you have the myth, and then you have the metaphor, and then you have the description. You need to grow into that. It's like a digestive process. So for me, my step, my world, my trail, my, let's call it, curriculum into science was that too. So I found that knowledge, and I realized that the description of science is not good enough. We need to connect it to how we are describing it. The subjective and the objective need to be combined. And that's when I went into medical school, realized that they were entranced and mesmerized and hypnotized by this scientific model, and thought that the body was material, and as a result they could not see that the life is actually immaterial, that consciousness is immaterial, that the thoughts that they use to describe all these things, you cannot measure them, you cannot weigh them, you cannot see what volume they have, you cannot see the chemical reactivity of thoughts. That means that the whole model of physics or chemistry of electromagnetism doesn't really work at that level of our thinking. So the subjective world of our thinking and the objective world of our descriptions need to be somehow bridged, and that's why I went into medical school. How is it possible that these materials of the body, which are actually produced by the cells, and they're fixed and positioned by the cells, and they actually enhance the communication between the cells, so the cells build the body for their purpose, but what we don't see is how the cells communicate in doing that. So how can we get to that? And that's where I discovered that, let's say that's the difference between science and research. Science looks at the things that we can see, describes in words that we know, and research looks at the things that we cannot yet see and has to find words for what we do not yet know. But research is the only foundation for science. Science is only consequential to research. So the science or the known is the consequence of the quest of the unknown, or the quest for knowing, the quest for learning. In me, that quest for science, the quest for knowing, the quest for learning has been operative. I, in a way, have never been satisfied with knowing something. Yes, I publish lots of things, and I have difficulty in publishing things because every time I write something down, I know that it is a piece of the puzzle, but only from the perspective where I stand at that moment, and only as a result of the path that I've taken up to then. And it is not the perspective from the other side or from another pathway. That's also why I have always presented my material in cybernetics and system theory conferences. System theory is the theoretical part, cybernetics is the applied part, and I'm always on the system theoretical part of it, because once you put it into a form, you have fixed it or fossilized it. That's where the wife of Lot becomes frozen as a salt pillar, because the vital essence of what makes it turn or churn or function is lost. It's a fossilization program. So the only way to stay away from that is to realize that whatever I have published is only a tiny Tim footsteps in the sand of the walk that I have taken in this curriculum of research, and the step that I am of where I am standing there. But what I describe will be immaterial a moment later. And that's a totally different way of thinking than, let's say, the scientist. How they think that they know, they refer to things as knowledge and they hang on to them, but they have the difficulty that they cannot let go of it at the moment that they really, really need to do so. The Copenhagen Convention is an example of that. Researchers had discovered that the material world was in fact chemical. The Einstein equations apply to it for molecular motion, and that the molecular was actually atomic, and the Planck equations accounted for that. So that meant that everything in the universe is an electromagnetic field, interacting with the electromagnetic field. And to describe that in the sense of matter or molecules is nonsensical. And they realized that in the Copenhagen Convention, that was the quest of how do we deal with it, and they decided not to deal with it. They say, let's just pretend that everything is material, and let's just pretend that everything is particular, even though they knew that it couldn't be. So they reversed the agenda of scientific research, and from that moment on, science basically got frozen into the past. And 100 years after Einstein and Planck, nothing much of progress had been made. Even though a lot had been discovered, it could not philosophically, psychologically, sociologically be integrated into the level of understanding of science, for the simple reason that scientists were unwilling to let go of this idea that the world is material. They needed to let go of it, and then of course they would have realized that the world is spiritual. That's a phase information field of pure information in formation, and that actually determines what atoms will form, how atoms will form, where and when atoms will form, and how these atoms will form clusters, which we then call molecules, and that then can build matter. So there is that mindset of looking at things as they are, as science does, and the mindset of things as they might be or could we be of the researcher. And I've found that it is often difficult to fully bridge that. I can bring the pebbles to the shore and show that you can look at it a different way and understand things in a different manner, come to different conclusions. But then I need to go on, because it is not just that step ahead that we can make. We need to do the other steps as well. We need to change the whole format of thinking, the whole substrate of thinking. We need to realize that not what we think is the problem, but how we think is the problem. And that's also where I did a lot of exercises on meditative and breathing techniques and other types, which was also why I went into medicine studies, to see how that works. and why that works. And yes, I did find it all. But the explanation is at the other end of the spectrum of things. It's at the spectrum of nothings, the no things, which is basically what all the old philosophy said, that the things come from the no things. But then they replace no thing by nothing and think that it is not a thing, while in fact a no thing means there is no things at all. There is an unthing, it's an unthinking, which is necessary for that. And that's where the meditation and the other techniques come in to, in a way, let the thinking stop so that the patterns of thinking can dissolve and the process of thinking can unravel itself and find its coherence and simplify itself. And that's also where you then discover that all of these bits of knowledge are like snowflakes which dissolve and then become one large drop of water, which then actually later on evaporates. So there is that whole other way of working with the mind, recognizing, respecting the mind, which is typical for the researcher and which is not addressed by the scientists. And you can also see that the scientists don't talk about consciousness. They don't talk about different states of consciousness. When they research it, they measure different electrical currents in the brain or in the body. And I say, well, that's it. Well, actually, that's not it, because that's just the electromagnetic current. But the electromagnetic current is the consequence of a shift between the electric and the magnetic. And the electric is only in the body, the magnetic is outside of the body, so you need to go from the particular to the universal, which is where science then turns into spiritual. And then you can actually see how everything connects. But how can you describe that? And the same for my work on freedom of choice. With the description of freedom of choice, I can describe that we can never describe what freedom of choice is, where it is, how it operates, and how to use it, while in fact I can describe exactly where it is and when it is and how it is and why it is. It's just that you cannot describe it for the simple reason that that description is no longer valid when you made it. It could also be the opposite, or it could also be a consequential because something in the environment changed. So in freedom of choice you can actually see that, just as the alchemist described, you need to understand the quintessence, and actually freedom of choice is also the quintessence, it is also the quantum flip, and that at that level the material doesn't matter, it's immaterial. But it is the kind of soundboard or the echo chamber or the Wilson cloud chamber in which we can see how the invisible, immaterial, spiritual freedom of choice operates. It's a kind of rear view mirror by which we can see the unseeable. And of course it is unseeable because with the electron microscope you can only see things at the size of the electron, not what is below that. And in the subatomic we are at the level where electrons are huge monsters of beings, and we need to look much smaller and much larger, much wider, much deeper, much more connected, but much less material. So in my development I had to go through a series of stages. Yes, I was curious as a child, and yes, I learned things in school, and I discovered that schools are not good at answering questions. Actually, I became a teacher myself later on and discovered that the educational system disempowers teachers from dealing with questions of students. So the teachers are actually taught to not think, but to work with the models of knowledge instead of the capacities for learning. That, of course, is destructive for the whole of society, because if you have people who can repeat what somebody else has said, that doesn't mean that they can think for themselves. And that's also why I was so dissatisfied with the schools, that they don't have enough of that space for learning how to think. Let's call it the traditional Greek or antique Egyptian philosophy, to be able to question the questions. to question the teacher and to question the knowledge of the teacher. Later I discovered that, yeah, if the student fails the exam, is it that the teacher didn't explain it correctly, or that the teacher didn't have the right knowledge, or that the books from which the teacher worked were actually wrong? It could well be that the student was right. But how can you see that if the teacher assumes that the book is right? While we now know over the courses of history that the history of the knowledge or the science of the past is actually not valid anymore in the present. We have learned to look at it in a different way. So it's much more important to learn to look at it in that different way, and that's not part of the schooling. So in a way, I became an autodidact for that kind of learning. I need to teach myself, to learn by myself. How can you get to know the unknown? Yes, I followed the regular schooling, but for me that was no more than the trellis or the scaffolding for building the bridge of the other side of it. How can you think differently? How can you come to know differently? And those are very subtle things, and often very unrecognizable at first. It's a bit as if when you draw circles in the sand, you can easily see it and it will persist. When you draw circles in the water, you cannot as easily see it. When you draw circles in the air, you will not see it. It's only from the water that you can learn that in the air those circles will be there. By the way, that's also why the Romans called that level of immaterial the spiritual. It was like air. You know that it is there, but you cannot see it. So for me, the quest was always about looking beyond what we can see and thinking beyond what we can know, and also specifically looking for the questions which don't have answers in that sense. For example, there was a phase in my life where I had the question why for everything, and I did that question for 7 years, and after 7 years I knew that the answer was because. And it is not the answer because that parents give to their children, but because I knew that if you ask the question in that way, it is because you're already not seeing a fullness of what you're looking at, and that incompleteness will trigger a kind of internal response, which we have then the experience of as a questioning mode. But that simply means that you need to orient yourself differently and be a different cause for what you're looking at. So it is not because, but rather be, comma, cause. And that's what superstring theory and unified field theory is actually learning, that at that level of information integration, information organization, the phase organization of the universe, quantum field, when you interact with that, you are already creating causes, and you will have to learn to live with the effect, as magic, of course, already implies. So then, in those schools, I realized that the learning of knowledge doesn't, say, satisfy the hunger of that question. It's a bit in the same way as you're hungry, you have a meal. But then the hunger doesn't disappear, for the simple reason that you digest what you ate, and in that same way you digest the knowledge that you got. And out of that comes the capacity, with the food you have the capacity to walk over the earth, with the information you have the capacity to expand in the universe. So there was that learning that took place, and from the child to the school student to the university student, I then realized that I had to be the answer to the questions. But I also discovered that if I have a question, somehow I will find an answer. But it is a bit like a meditation. I need to hold the question I need to not let it dissolve or disappear or deteriorate into other things. And it is very tricky. It's like holding a flower in the hand, or rather holding a butterfly in your hand. To hold a thought in your head is like using an electromagnetic force field to hatch a tornado out of the void of the space. This is the level where language can only be poetic, because we can no longer refer to the things. We need to go to the unthings, the no things. And those are the principles which we cannot see. So most of the learning in my research pathway was about realizing that in the outer world with other people, I need to learn to talk in language that they can recognize. But just like repeating a story is not interesting, I need to use the words that people know to describe things that they do not yet know. And for me that was very difficult. When I was in engineering school, I actually created a new line, a new language of logic. And actually within a line of symbols, I could write a page of understanding. And for me it became very difficult because I had those symbols, and there were, say, 16 forms of equation signs. And there were 4 to 8, depending on how you group it, notations for perspective and percepts. There were logical connectors of and disconnectors. There were association symbols, dissociation symbols. So in a sense, it was a language of a chemistry of how to connect thoughts. And most of the language of the logic was about a starting point of an idea, and then basically showing a pathway of how in the mind you can navigate and go from one way of looking at it to another, connecting, disconnecting, outside, inside, material, immaterial. And as a result, see how it transforms into other ideas which we know. So that logic made it possible to connect ideas which otherwise would seem unconnectable. And that logic made it possible to see how structures are flow forms, are transformations, are forms of information, and so on. But the difficulty that I had is nobody else could understand that. I could show them an equation and say, well, this is what it says. But they couldn't understand it. The words that I used, they knew. But the way I used the words was from a kind of thinking that they didn't know. I didn't realize that, because I thought, if I can think that, everybody can think that. It's only later that I realized that people crystallize their thought patterns in specific forms, a bit like we do in our body. I discovered that much later, also from studying our body. So in that sense, I then discovered that with that logic, I could understand it. And inside of me, I still use that logic. I don't use notation anymore. And sometimes wonder if I should. And sometimes I regret it, but on the other hand, I know that the reason why I stopped with it is that there is something else going on, which is that it is not about the description which that formulation with that symbol set allows for, but that it needs to be digested internally, it needs to be experienced. And so that's where, also through the study of medicine, I realized whatever I describe, I must be able to describe it as a process in our body. In our body, all these logical operators, all these symbols that I had are there. Cell division is one of those processes. The cell membrane is one of those processes. The crystallization of muscle into bone is one of those processes. They're all there. The whole body is a logical operator. The whole body is a motherboard for phase-based transmutation calculations. So if I can describe it in terms of the body, then I implicitly already have that language of the logical connectors and disconnectors that I used before. But also, I now have it in a terminology or a terrain which people share. They all have a body. So in their body, they can know it. Even if they didn't know it, that's the principle of philosophy, to explain what people already knew but they didn't know that they knew, then in their body they can experience it. And so a lot of my research is now at a level where, let's say, thoughts are being felt, but it is a tricky kind of thing because that process of research is, how can I describe it? That's the difficulty I always have. I need to use words that other people know to describe things which are not describable, which are not physical at all, which are not tangible at all. So how can you describe that? The thinking process is a bit like water flows within water flows. That on the oceans you have the surface waves, you have the tidal waves, you have the Gulf streams, you have the rain coming down, the water evaporating. Those processes we have in the thought world as well. But we don't feel them as the wind blowing on our skin. When the classic researchers refer to spiritus, or for the Greeks pneuma, the Indians prana, they refer to the movements of the air for these kind of processes which operate within us, but we can sort of experience around us. And that's also the whole translation in India, when the Chinese talk about the qi, or the Vikings talk about od, or the Japanese talk about the ki, the prana in the body is doing the same as the air outside of the body. And at that level of research where I am, most of the things are like breezes or movements or pulsations or pressures of that kind. But then as if you're in a dance of the wind, but it's on the inside of the body. I can fully understand why they have tried to describe that in Chinese and Indian traditional formulations as the light fields in the body. I'm not at the level that I can see the colors of the light field, because that is not the level where I am describing. Then I would be looking at and describing again instead of experiencing and being in it. The transformations of the unknown to the known is the digestion of what is not to what can be. It's the creative process itself. It's the universal process of creation as it operates within us. And in this kind of research, it is something to be felt, and sometimes it's very strong, sometimes it is very subtle, sometimes it is very in the moment, like the cracking of the egg, and sometimes it takes years to hatch the egg. And it's very difficult to describe because all of these processes are there at the same time. I know that, for example, I can take an idea, I can put it somewhere in that light field or wind field or creative field, phase field. The description of the phase fields are most appropriate for this. And then I can feel it, but I'm feeling all these other things at the same time. And that's a bit the difficulty I have in understanding the antenna. How does the antenna know which radio station it is listening to and which frequency is part of the note of the C of the Beethoven symphony, or of that one word that this person is talking in the talk show? In the field itself, they're all connected, interconnected, intermingling. And I still try to get a better grasp of how I'm actually able to pull them apart, take them apart. And I know that I can, because often I wake up, I have a dream, I come out of the dream, and the dream can be nonsensical. It can be totally... I have difficulty to describe any kind of meaning to some of those dreams. But then out of the dream comes a word, and when I start to write with that word as a seed crystal, it can't be that I'm busy for an hour or 4 hours or more, because that is the handle on a flow of ideas which all interconnect and which give clarity to questions that I had before. At the moment, for example, I'm trying to resolve the answer of the riddle, what's the relation of the human to humanity? Because as a human, you are humanity. You're two parents, their two parents, their two parents, and so on. You contain all of humanity within you. How can you feel that? How can you acknowledge that? How can you process that? How can you act from that? So, in knowing all of humanity, being all of humanity, how can you be more precise in what you are doing there, where you are, which benefits all of humanity? In the past, they would have called that God, the collective being of us all, and the collective being in the university, in the universe as a whole. So, in delving with these kind of questions, I have a series of questions which I then unravel by a bit like polyester is being made. It's a kind of pot of full of soup. You dip a needle in it, pull the needle out, and out comes this string, a bit like some of these molten cheeses. And then out of that, these strings of thought form. So that is the transition of the unknown to the known, of the unthinkable to the words, and then it's just a matter of hoping that other people can understand that too. Basically, that is the research of the research, so to say. Just let me just leave it at this. There's more to say about that, but essentially, what I try to say that research is different from science, just like the unknown is different from the known. And that the connection between them is like an information processes, which is very similar to how we digest food. And it's not an experience in the world around us, but of the world within us. How we connect to the universe as a whole.